Okay, so this is Bio 241, and it's Thursday, February 5th, and we have a test next time, on Tuesday, right, on chapters 1, 2, 3, and 6. And then we'll get that out of the way, and then maybe we'll move on to chapter 4 today, if I can get done with 6. And, of course, what do you need for this test coming up? You need your picture ID. All right, so your Cypress College picture ID, that's best to have. Any kind of picture ID will work if it's a real ID, right? Like a, that's just a fake one, but a Fullerton College, and it's got to have a picture on there for you. You need a basic scientific non-graphing calculator, a calculator that doesn't have a phone or an encyclopedia or some kind of link to the outside world in it, right? I don't know if you can even buy calculators without phones in them these days. Hopefully so. And what else? You need, oh, I don't have it on here. You need a Scantron, an 882. Does anybody have a Scantron on them to hold up? People tell me it's green colored. That's it. That's a nice one. That's a nice one. I think that's a nice one. I'm not quite sure. Maybe I don't like that one. The ones that I like, all right, if it's for question number 5, like this, all right, it's going to have 5 circles, and these circles should be clear. There are some that are filled in. They have a gray background. Sometimes the Scantron reader has difficulty with that one. So what's the number on yours? It's an 882ES?
E.
Or just E?
E.
Lovas?
Yeah.
Ah, the Lovas I don't like so much because the Scantron reader has difficulty. Other Scantrons, these are all labeled. The labels I like are A, B, C, D, E. They're capital letters. Other Scantrons have, in the bubbles that you have to fill in, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Well, I don't make my tests up with numbers. My answers are A, B, C, D, E. So if you have one with numbers on it, you got to make the correction in your mind. And if you're under a lot of stress, maybe you would make a mistake, right? So just get the ones that have A, B, C, D, E across it, and not the Lovas ones. And, of course, then you need a pencil, a good pencil. But the most important thing is a good eraser, because if you smudge up your Scantron, it's not going to get red, and you're going to get gypped out of points. And I think I have in here someplace that once I give a Scantron back to a student, I don't regrade it. All right, so if you make a lot of smudges on your Scantron, make sure that you see me or your lab instructor, and we'll go over the test with you before you get it back. So you'll get them back in lab unless you come see me during office hours, and the key you'll see in lab. So you'll be able to check your test to see what the correct answers were. All right, so that will happen a little while after you take the test. All right, so any questions on the test? Yeah?
The whole thing will be on Scantron?
The whole thing will be on Scantron. It's possible sometime I might have you write a short answer question or something, but I don't think on this first test. All right? So the types of questions that you will get, multiple choice, similar to what you've seen online and at the back of the chapter. There are matching questions where you have to match things up. There could be true-false. I'm not really big on true-false type questions, but usually there's a couple. And then there's always going to be some graphical component to the test, too, where you'll see a picture of something, and you'll have to label that picture from a list, right? So again, it's just going to be fill in the answer. You won't. It's not like a practicum where you have to know spelling. All right, so that's pretty much the whole test. Hour and a half. And my guess is if you look at all this, if you look at the study guide, you'll get done with the test really fast. You know, somebody's going to be done in 35 minutes. But if you don't study, you know, you'll be in here for an hour and a half. So the more you study, the more fun it will be, of course. Yeah?
Before we start chapter 4, can we ask questions about the test?
Sure. Yeah. Yeah, I'll be happy to answer questions. Sure. Okay, I might have to cut it off, but we'll see. I'll take questions and see how it goes, because I don't want to like lecture over chapter 2 from the beginning again. But if you have questions, yeah, we can talk about that. Okay. All right. All right, so we were like, where? Right here? Right here. Okay. Let's get started with this. I suppose that was an okay place to stop last time, but remember we were talking about active transport and passive transport. Let me get my arrow working right here. And is anybody in the back row? No, I'm going to turn off this light then. All right, so active transport is, which way are molecules moving for active transport? From low to high. For passive transport is from high to low. And what is necessary in order to move something passively from low, actively from low to high? What else is necessary? Yeah, energy more generally, and ATP is that source of energy in our cells in order for that to happen. So active transport needs energy, and we see that in the form of ATP. We also saw what? We saw that glucose cannot enter a cell, even though there is a nice diffusion gradient. Glucose wants to enter a cell, going from high concentration to low, but it can't because of this hydrophobic region of the plasma membrane. So there has to be some kind of transporter to allow glucose to go down its concentration gradient. So here's a transporter. So glucose has to bind at an active site first. There's got to be a relationship between the active site and the molecule that's being transported, and that is defined by its shape. Right, the shapes have to be complementary to each other. And then when glucose binds, that's like poking you in the side. That's going to change conformation of this protein. And so now the protein is open to the inside of the cell and glucose diffuses down a concentration gradient, even though there's this phospholipid barrier that's separating the intracellular and extracellular space. Other proteins change conformation when they hydrolyze ATP. And if that's the case, then, for instance, this calcium can actually go from low concentration to high concentration. All right? But that's active transport. This is still passive. This is what we call facilitated diffusion. Right? Is that sort of ringing a bell from last time? All right. Well, we're going to, and this, of course, was active transport right here because it's utilizing ATP, active transport here. So from this, you should know, where is sodium usually high? Outside the cell. Where's potassium high? Inside the cell, because the sodium potassium ATP pump is working all the time. And remember that it is not equal. It's not a one-to-one transport. What's the ratio of, 3 to 2, three what to what? Three sodiums for every two potassiums, right? And when that happens, you can see that the inside of the cell gets to be a little bit negative, right? If we start pumping out more positive ions, then the inside of the cell becomes a little bit negative as a result of that. All right, then we described a little bit what's the difference between primary active transport and passive transport. Primary active transport is going to utilize energy, chemical energy, in the form of ATP. Passive transport is going to move something from low concentration to high, right? It's still active transport, so it requires energy. But what is the form of that energy? It's not in the form of ATP. It's in the form of a concentration gradient of some other kind of molecule. And what's being used here is a sodium concentration gradient. So there certainly is energy in a concentration gradient. That's all there's to it. And it can be used to move things up a concentration gradient. We call this secondary active transport. So for secondary active transport, there's something else that maybe should catch your eye. There are always two molecules that are going to be moving, not just one. All right, so in this particular case, the two molecules are what? Sodium as well as glucose. Okay. All right, so don't forget, there's energy in the concentration gradient. And here was a nice example of secondary active transport where we have glucose. Glucose is low on the outside of the cell, high on the inside of the cell. Sodium is high where? Outside, low inside. So sodium wants to diffuse down a concentration gradient. Right? So there's energy in the sodium gradient, and that energy can be used to transport glucose from low to high. So this is an example of secondary active transport. Right? In this case, both molecules have to bind to the protein. When both molecules bind, that changes a conformation, or that changes the conformation of this transporter, and then glucose can enter the cell. And in this diagram, do you see ATP being used anywhere? No. So that's a dead giveaway that this is what kind of active transport? Secondary active transport, utilizing the energy in the gradient of sodium across this membrane. All right, so here is, I guess, maybe where we left off last time. This kind of puts it all together for you. How does glucose, we're primarily interested in glucose, how does glucose move across an epithelial membrane using these transport mechanisms that we looked at? All right, so here we have, for instance, we got a couple different structures. It could be absorption from the gastrointestinal tract, or it could be tubular reabsorption in the kidney tubule. And maybe you should have to flash back on anatomy and remember the three processes by which urine is made by, and the tubular elements and the vascular elements of the nephron, for instance, right? So I'm going to be talking about that on this particular slide. And remember that an epithelium is polar. Now, what does that mean? That means something a little bit different than what we've been talking about. It means that the apical surface of the epithelium or the epithelial cells is different than the basolateral surface of this membrane. So it is polar. It's different because there are different membrane proteins inserted into the membrane. So here is a membrane protein, and that's a lot different than this sodium-potassium ATP pump right here. It's different than this facilitated diffusion transporter. All right, so let's look and see how glucose can go from into a low concentration in the blood. Okay, from a low concentration in the filtrate of a kidney tubule to high concentration inside the cell. All right, so what kind, and just generally speaking, what kind of transport is it when something goes from low concentration to high concentration? That's active transport, right? That's active transport. All right, so we don't want to lose any glucose in the urine. So if this is a kidney filtrate right here, if glucose was not reabsorbed, it would end up in the urine and it would be voided from the person. All right, but glucose is an important energy molecule. It keeps you alive. So for instance, what's an important energy molecule in your car? Gasoline, right? So would you go to the gasoline station and fill your gasoline tank up with gasoline and then put a hole in the gas tank and let it dribble out? Oh, that would be silly. Waste of energy, waste of money. Your body doesn't do that either, right? So when glucose ends up in the filtrate of the kidney, it's resorbed so that you don't lose it from your body, because that's an important energy source. So how can it go from low concentration to high? You just told me active transport, all right? So here is a co-transporter. All right, we see sodium at high concentration in the filtrate and inside the cell. What can you tell me about sodium? It's low. So there is a gradient of sodium. Sodium wants to diffuse inside the cell. And, of course, our bodies want to resorb glucose from the filtrate. So here is a transporter that binds both sodium and glucose, uses the energy in the sodium gradient to move glucose from low concentration to high concentration. So, and do you see any ATP being used right here? Absolutely not. So this is active transport, but what kind of active transport is that? That's secondary active transport, and in particular, this is co-transport because both sodium and glucose are doing what? Going in the same direction. If they were going in opposite directions, what would we call that? That would be counter-transport, all right? But in this particular protein on the apical membrane, that is co-transport, which is a special kind of secondary active transport. All right, so now you have high glucose inside the cell, and it's relatively low in the plasma. So what do you call this process of glucose moving from high concentration to low? That's passive. And it just wants to do that all by itself, right? Because there is energy just in the glucose gradient. But remember, glucose can't get across this membrane because why? Because there's that big hydrophobic region and glucose is a polar molecule. It can't diffuse. So there has to be a protein right here that will help that process. And we showed you what that protein looks like right here, right? That's a GLUT4 transporter. And That process is called facilitated diffusion, which is passive transport. Okay, now what maintains the sodium gradient properly for this cotransporter to work? It is this sodium-potassium ATP pump right here. So it's moving sodium from low concentration to high. All right, it's moving potassium from low concentration to high. And it's hydrolyzing ATP. So do you believe that this is active transport or not? Yes, because things are going from low concentration to high, right? That's active transport. Now, what kind of active transport is that? Is that primary or secondary? Okay, and it's really easy to see that that's primary active transport. Why? Because there's ATP right there that's being utilized, right? And this is easy to see that this is secondary active transport because there's no ATP, it's a sodium gradient that's being used. Okay, so now we have glucose actually moving across the full membrane and being resorbed into the blood. So that's tubular resorption. A similar process takes place in the digestive tract as well. All right, let's talk about bulk transport. Any questions on that? That's an important exam figure somewhere along the line. Okay, so make sure that you can see that figure from, understand it from across the room. Bulk transport is when you have material that's moved in or out of the cell utilizing vesicles and the fusion of vesicles to the plasma membrane. All right, so if we have particles outside that the cell needs for its activity inside the cell, it can form a little dimple. The materials will then just diffuse into this dimple right here, and then the cell membrane completely forms around those particles, and this little dimple breaks away from the plasma membrane, and now these particles are inside the cell within this vesicle right here. So this requires ATP because the integral proteins of the membrane are attached to microfilaments and microtubules that are pushing and pulling on the membrane that requires ATP for that to happen. So this bulk transport is always going to be active transport, even though I don't have an ATP shown on the diagram right here. So this process, right, is what we call endocytosis, right? So when something enters the cell, that's endocytosis, and there are two forms of endocytosis that you should be aware of. If what is being endocytosed is a large, almost insoluble molecule, then that's what we call phagocytosis, if it's a particle. If it's just liquid or if it's just a solution and it gets imported into the cell, then that's what we call pinocytosis. All right, and the reverse is possible. You might have some product right here. Maybe this is a mucus molecule. It's a protein modified with a sugar that's was made by the rough endoplasmic reticulum and then shipped via vesicles to what organ modifies and packages. The Golgi body, right, will then modify that protein by conjugating it with a sugar molecule, forming mucus. So now we have mucus inside this vesicle, and it is secreted to the outside of the cell by fusing this vesicle to the plasma membrane. So this is what we call exocytosis, and again, that is an active process requiring ATP. All right, so is bulk transport a form of passive or active transport? Active, yeah. It takes ATP to move those vesicles around, to get them to hop rides on the microfilaments and microtubules. Okay, membrane potential. When you see this word potential right here, you should think of voltage. All right, but before we get to this topic, do we have any questions over what I covered? It was pretty basic. You probably learned that in anatomy. All right, but when you see this term potential, you should also just think of voltage. Potential and voltage are exactly the same thing. And what the heck is voltage? A voltage is a gradient of electrical charge. There's going to be some area where there's a high electrical charge. There's going to be another area that has a low area of electrical charge. And what can you tell me about any kind of gradient? What can you tell me about a gradient? What is it really? What is a gradient of something? What can it be used for? Okay, it is a form of energy. Just like a sodium gradient is a form of energy, and any energy can be used to do work. So a voltage can be used to do work in our bodies. All right, so but before we start talking about biology, let's think about everyday kinds of applications. What devices do you own that contain a voltage? A light bulb is I don't like that one necessarily because can you turn a light bulb on by itself? If you just had a light bulb in your hand, would it turn on? No. So there really isn't energy in a light bulb. A light bulb needs energy to emit light. So in order for a light bulb to emit light, what do you have to do to it? You got to plug it into something, right? You have to plug it into a voltage source, for instance. Okay, so a light bulb doesn't really contain energy, but what are some other things that contain energy that you have?
Batteries,
right. Batteries contain energy because they separate electrical charges out, and you can use a battery to, I don't have one in my pocket, I turned it off. You can use a battery to power your cell phone, right, or calculator, or other kinds of electronic devices, right? So a battery is just a storage form of energy to power different electrical devices. And I'm sure all of us have a battery in our cars. Some of us maybe even have a big enough battery where we can drive around on it. Others, most of us just have a battery to start the car, and then it uses gasoline to move around. But a battery just stores energy for us. Now, how many terminals does a battery have? Has anybody ever looked at a battery to see how many terminals it has? It has two, right? And so remember, if the battery runs down, you got to hook it up to another car and use it to start your engine. How many wires do you hook up to your car? There are two, right? So every battery has two terminals. All right. So here is a cell right here. And a cell has numerous fixed anions inside the cell. That means these are large molecules that can't move across the plasma membrane right here. And an anion has what kind of electrical charge on it? Negative charge, right? Okay. And so these negative charges, what can you tell me about the association between negative charges and positive charges? Do they repel or attract? They attract, right? Because then they'll neutralize each other. All right. So these fixed anions right here are going to attract some positive electrical charges across the membrane. And these electrical charges are due to potassium ions right here. All right. So what's the charge on this potassium ion? It's positive, right? So that's why these anions right here attract it in. All right, so potassium enters the cell because there are membrane channels for potassium. And you would maybe guess that it would attract enough potassium charges to completely neutralize all of these anions that are inside the cell. Okay, and then everything would be neutralized. All right, but that's really not what happens, because as potassium enters the cell, what develops? You get more potassium inside the cell than out. So what does sodium want to do just by the concentration gradient? It wants to go outside the cell, right? So potassium wants to enter because it's being attracted by these anions inside the cell, but as they enter, right, it sees a concentration gradient and they actually want to leave the cell. Right, so you can't get as many electrical potassium ions in to neutralize all these fixed anions. And when I say fixed, maybe I'm not sure I mentioned why they're fixed. Why are they fixed inside the cell? Because they're too big to move through the plasma membrane. Right, so they would maybe want to diffuse out, but they're too big to get across the membrane. Sodium can't help out with this particular process because the membrane is not permeable to sodium. So sodium is really just stuck on the outside of the cell. All right, so the inside of the cell, because not enough potassium can enter to neutralize these fixed anions, becomes negatively charged compared to the outside of the cell. So there is a separation of charge across the membrane right here, and you can think of this cell membrane or the cell is acting like a battery. The inside is negative and the outside is positive. And we can put a voltmeter to measure what that voltage is. We could stick one terminal right on the outside of the cell and actually poke an electrode on the inside of the cell, and we'll measure a voltage across the membrane as a result of that. Right? And what we would see in most cells, well, at least due to potassium, would be minus 90 millivolts, with the inside being negative compared to the outside of the cell. All right, so every cell does this. So what does every cell in your body act like? It actually acts like a battery. All the cells, all those trillions of cells, if they're alive, act like batteries. Yeah. Okay, that's a resting membrane potential. I'll tell you what it is. You know what? No, this is due to the potassium ion only. And I'm going to talk about the resting membrane potential as being the summation of a number of effects, okay, in just a little bit. Okay, so the equilibrium potential, right, has to do, remember that potassium is attracted inside the cell because of the electrical charge, but potassium also wants to diffuse out. And if we let the electrical attraction and the diffusion work for a long period of time, it's going to reach equilibrium to where there's no potassium entering or leaving the cell. It's reached a happy medium. So there are two forces, this electrical attraction and the concentration gradient that is causing potassium to diffuse out of the cell. All right, so if a membrane is permeable to only potassium, it would diffuse until it reaches an equilibrium potential or voltage. All right, don't forget, there are two forces acting on this potassium and they're operating in two different directions. What is the force that is moving potassium inside the cell? It's the electrical attraction, right? Because these are negative charges and potassium is positive. And what is the opposite force? It's the concentration gradient, right? As potassium builds up inside the cell, if we were to ignore all the electrical charges, it would want to diffuse out down its concentration gradient. That's all there's to it. So at equilibrium, these two forces exactly cancel out and balance each other out. And that's what we call the equilibrium potential. And that equilibrium potential for potassium is this minus 90 millivolts. So this right here is the electrical potential that is keeping these potassium inside the cell, not allowing them to diffuse out, right, at equilibrium. And there is an equation that we can use to compute what that electrical potential is. And we use an equation called the Nernst equation to figure that out. All right, the Nernst equation gives the membrane potential needed to counteract the concentration forces acting on an ion. All right, so don't forget, the concentration force is trying to push potassium out of the cell. But that electrical force is, what, dragging it in. And the Nernst equation tells us what is the voltage inside the cell where these two forces are exactly balanced out. All right, so the value of that voltage, equilibrium voltage, depends on the ratio of ion concentrations inside and outside of the cell. So here you have the concentration of, for instance, we were talking about potassium outside the cell divided by the concentration inside the cell. Then you take the log of that and multiply it by this constant right here, which is 61 divided by Z. And Z is pretty easy to figure out. Z is the valence of that particular ion. It's just the electrical charge on that ion. So what could you tell me about the electrical charge of sodium? What's the electrical charge of sodium? It's one. What kind of one is it? It's a positive one, right? So we would just put a positive one right here. What's 61 divided by positive one? Nope. It's just a positive one. It's just a positive 61, right? So 61 divided by one is just 61. Okay. All right. So that would be the Nernst equation. All right. So this slide is kind of important because it defines for you in a normal cell what the concentrations are of these three important electrolytes or ions inside the cell compared to outside the cell. So for sodium, where is sodium high? Outside the cell, 45 millimolar versus only 12 millimolar inside the cell. All right. So what you should know from this slide is you should know the direction of the concentration gradient for sodium, namely sodium is high outside the cell. You don't have to know these numbers, right? If you have to know these numbers, I'll tell you the numbers. You just have to know where sodium is high. And sodium is high where? Outside the cell. Where is potassium high? Inside the cell. And on the slide, it tells you what the concentrations are. You don't have to memorize the concentrations, but you got to know that on the outside of the cell, potassium is? It's low. Yeah, I tricked you just a little bit. It's high on the inside of the cell. Now, what about for chlorine ion right here? It is high where? It's high outside. And what about for calcium? It is high outside as well. All right, so the Nernst equation will tell you what the membrane voltage is only for one ion at a time, what the contribution is of these ions to the overall membrane potential. So if you wanted to calculate what the equilibrium potential for potassium is, what would you do? Well, here, what's the concentration of potassium outside the cell? Potassium is here, outside it's 5 millimolar, right? And here, what's the concentration inside? 150, you would plug that in, divide these two numbers, and then take the log of it, and then multiply it by 61, and then you would divide by Z. And what's Z? It is plus 1. Which is really not, you don't have to divide by plus 1, it's just equal to whatever you have. All right, and that would tell you what the equilibrium membrane potential is for potassium. All right, if you want to calculate the equilibrium potential for sodium, what would you put here for X out? It would be 145, yeah, I did that right, divided by 12, right? Find out what that is equal to, then take the log of it, and multiply it by 61 because Z is equal to what? Plus 1 again, right? So that doesn't enter into it. All right, but now what about for chlorine? What would we do? Outside is 125, inside is 9. Divide those numbers, take the log of it, and now 61 is what? What is Z? You're going to have 61 divided by minus 1. So you got to multiply by minus 61. That will tell you what the voltage is due to this chlorine ion. Okay, so you can see that the gradient for sodium is similar to the gradient for chlorine, but the equilibrium potential is different, opposite, because why? Chlorine is an anion. It's not a cation. All right, so that's easy to calculate. And what about for calcium? You can plug these numbers into this equation right here, but what would you use for Z? You'd have to use 2 right here, right? And then you would get the equilibrium membrane potential. So from this slide, you should be familiar with this equation, okay? But more importantly, which ions are high concentration or are at a high concentration inside the cell? Which are high inside the cell compared to the outside? It's really only potassium. Which are high outside the cell? Calcium, chlorine, and sodium. Okay, so that's really what you should know from this particular slide. What is the concentration gradient for these ions right here? And then here is a little check of if you want to practice calculating the membrane potential. Okay, I think this right here maybe is not correct. I think it's maybe 66. If anybody has their calculator, you can check that out. Okay, but that shows you how to calculate the membrane potential. Okay, now the Nernst equation. Can the Nernst equation tell you what the overall membrane potential is as a result of all of these ions right here? So here is the Nernst equation, and what is it good for? Only one ion at a time, not for all of them together. Okay, that's the basis of the Nernst equation. All right, now we get to the resting membrane potential. Right, the resting membrane potential is the voltage of a cell when it's not producing electrical impulses, when it's not working, when it's not sending information one way or the other, when it's at rest. The resting membrane potential, which we're always just going to call RMP for short, RMP in most cells is somewhere between minus 65 and minus 85, and it's minus on the inside compared to the outside of the cell. RMP depends on the concentrations of ions inside and outside the cell, right? And you can calculate according to one ion using that Nernst equation if you wanted to. All right, but it is also dependent on the permeability of each ion. And the one that is most permeable is potassium because there are leak channels in the membrane. So there are specific proteins that allow potassium to leak out of the cell. Okay, so the resting membrane potential, let's take a look at this. So here we have our voltmeter, We're measuring the voltage across the cell, positive on the outside, negative on the inside. Right? Some sodium diffuses into the cell, but not very much. Right? So if we were to look at the equilibrium membrane potential to sodium and potassium and add them together, let's see if we can add them together. All right, if we were to add these two together, what would we have? Minus 30, right? But what did we say? What is RMP normally? Minus 65 to 85, right? So we just can't add those two equilibrium membrane potentials together. There's something else affecting the membrane potential. And we see that sodium is a little bit leaky, okay? So as sodium moves into the cell, what happens to the charge inside the cell? Okay? It becomes what? Less negative as a result of that. Okay? So the resting membrane potential is less negative than that equilibrium potential for potassium. There is something else that's happening. Here is that sodium-potassium ATP pump. All right? So don't forget that it doesn't pump equal numbers of sodium-potassium. It pumps what? More sodium outside. So if more sodium is going outside, that makes the inside of this cell, what? More negative as a result of that, right? So this adds to the resting membrane potential. So the sodium-potassium ATP pump is what we call electrogenic because it doesn't allow the transport of equal quantities of sodium and potassium. So that adds a little electronegativity to the resting membrane potential. All right, so here are all the things that affect the resting membrane potential of a cell. All right, first, you start with those fixed anions, which make the inside of the cell really negative, right? And that does what? That attracts cations to the inside of the cell. But the one that's most permeable is potassium, not so much sodium, right? So that makes the inside of the cell a little bit negative, right? We have a high concentration inside the cell, all right, and a lower concentration of sodium inside the cell. The ATP pump, because it's not pumping equal numbers, right, makes the inside of the cell a little bit more negative. All right, so, and then just because of the uneven distribution of ions across the cell membrane, we can look at the Nernst equation. Oh yeah, here's minus 66. That's what it should be on that previous slide. All right. If we add all of these effects together, we get a typical resting membrane potential of minus 70 millivolts. Right? So you can't just add the Nernst numbers together. Right? But remember, it's not just potassium and sodium. What else would we even have to add in? We'd have to add in the effects of chlorine and calcium and how it affects the membrane potential. Okay, so all these things affect membrane potential, and that's how we come up with minus 70. We just can't add these two numbers together. Okay, now this right here, this gradient across the membrane, what is that really? What is that really? What's in your battery? What do you use a battery for? As an energy source, right? So this cell can use this electrical potential as an energy source, and you know what? We're going to start talking about that maybe in one of the next chapters, actually in two or three chapters from now. Okay, but you need to know how it develops. Okay, so we're going to change topics a little bit and talk about cell signaling. How do cells communicate with each other? And it can happen through a number of different ways. All right, but let's think of the basic building block of communication between cells. All right, the structural and functional unit of communication between cells is what we call a synapse. And I think we talked about this. What's the structural and functional unit of life? If you want to know something about life, what do you have to know about? The cell, right? And if you know how a cell functions, then you actually know a lot about life. All right, and if you want to know something about cell signaling, how cells communicate with each other, what should you really understand? You should understand the synapse right here, right? And if you understand the synapse, then you have a really good idea of how cells communicate with each other. All right, so there are two different general types of synapses in the body. There are electrical synapses and chemical synapses, right? And we're going to be talking about these different kinds of synapses, and I'm just going to begin to talk about them today so you get a little bit of an idea of what they are. Okay, so the general topic is cell signaling. All right, so cell signaling has to do with how cells communicate with each other, and this one right here is an example, okay, of an electrical synapse. Here we have two cells. You can see here's a plasma membrane of one, here's a plasma membrane of the next one, and you can see here is a tunnel that actually goes from the cytoplasm of one cell to the cytoplasm of another cell right here. This is what we call a gap junction. There are different kinds of junctions between cells, right? But this one is a tunnel. And this tunnel allows the movement of molecules directly from one cell to another, and in particular, the kind of molecule that moves, right, would be, for instance, a sodium ion. And and I just told you what kind of molecule sodium ion, what kind of molecule is a sodium ion? It's an ion, right? So it's an ion. It has an electrical charge on it. And what do we call an electrical charge in motion? What do we call an electrical charge that moves around from one place to another? That's what we call a current. That's an electrical current. So if you have a sodium ion, because it has an electrical charge, if it starts to move, that's an electrical current, right? And what can you tell me about sodium normally moving across this membrane right here? Can it move? No, right? Because this phospholipid bilayer acts like insulation, and it doesn't allow that electrical current to move from inside the cell to outside the cell. But sodium can move, right, through this gap junction. And when it moves, that's an electrical current that goes from one cell to the next, and that is a stimulatory effect on the cell that is receiving that sodium ion. Right, so electrical currents can directly go from one cell to the other right here if there is what between the cells, if there is a gap junction. Now, you probably learned what kinds of tissue have gap junctions. There is very rare, but there's one organ that's loaded with them. Cardiac muscle tissue, right? These are short cells, and the component of the intercalated disc is a gap junction so that when one myocardial cell gets stimulated electrically, that electrical current can go from one cell to the next cell to the next cell to the next cell. All the thousands of cells in the heart will be stimulated to contract at the same time, right? Because of what? These gap junctions. So one cell is signaling the next to contract via these gap junctions. And that's handy with the heart because you want your heart to contract as a unit. But what about skeletal muscle? Do you want skeletal muscle to contract as a unit? Would you like to have gap junctions between your skeletal muscles? You're laughing, okay, because it would be sort of funny. I could sort of demonstrate to you if skeletal muscle had gap junctions. All you have to do is contract one muscle fiber someplace in your body, and what would happen? All the muscles would contract, right? So that would be really hard to fill out the Scantron if that's the control you had over skeletal muscle, right? Heart is a different story. You want it to contract in unison, but skeletal muscle, not so. So skeletal muscle does not have what? Electrical synapses. It has other kinds of synapses that we're going to look at. Very few kinds of cells have electrical synapses. All right, now what? This picture right here is not in this chapter. I imported it from another chapter. I don't know what figure it is. It's maybe from chapter 4, maybe. All right, so if you want to go find it and read about it. But I think you're familiar with gap junctions. Okay, so here is going to be a different kind of synapse. All right, here we have one kind of cell that is releasing, synthesizing, and releasing a signaling molecule, and it diffuses through this little extracellular space, and it's going to cause excitation or maybe inhibition of these cells down over here. These are what we call the target cells. And this molecule, if it just diffuses through this interstitial space to the target cells, we call these a paracrine regulator or a paracrine signaling molecule. Right, so this is a paracrine. Now, how is it that these target cells right here can respond to this paracrine? Another way of maybe saying this euphemistically is, how do these target cells, how do they know to listen for a signal from this tissue up over here? How are they going to be stimulated? What do these target cells have to have in order to be aware of the paracrine agent right here? They have to have a receptor for it. So there has to be binding of this paracrine agent to some protein that's in the cell membrane right here. And we always describe the binding or the association between this molecule and the receptor as what, like a lock and key model. The shape of the signaling molecule has to be complementary to the shape of the receptor. So what must be the shape of the binding site for the paracrine receptor? So we have receptors right here. So here we have the paracrine. What's the shape of this molecule right here? It is round, spherical, right, or circular, however you want to think about it. What does the shape of the receptor or the binding site on the receptor have to be? Can it be square? Can it be rectangular? No, it has to be circular in order for this molecule to bind to it. Okay. All right, so paracrine signaling, cells secrete regulatory molecules that diffuse to what? Nearby cells. The nearby cells can only respond if they have a receptor for it, and the binding site has to be complementary in shape to the shape of the signaling molecule. All right, so this is one form of signaling. Here's another form of signaling, where you have a neuron, all right, and an electrical impulse comes down the axon of this neuron, and when it comes to the axon terminus, that electrical signal causes the release of a chemical, which we call a neurotransmitter, right, because it's coming from a neuron, and that neurotransmitter diffuses across this space between the neuron and the effector cell. And can anybody recognize this effector cell right here? This is a skeletal muscle, right? So when this neurotransmitter binds to, it has to bind to what on this skeletal muscle in order to stimulate the skeletal muscle? There's got to be, just like in this case, there has to be a receptor for it, right? And what's the shape of the binding site on the receptor compared to the signaling molecule? It has to be complementary in nature, right? So as in the previous case, here we have a nice round or spherical signaling molecule. The receptor has to have a binding site that is, what, round or spherical or something to accept that signaling molecule. And what it does, that sets up another electrical signal in this muscle right here. So this is what we call a chemical synapse, right? Because in the neuron, we have an electrical signal, which stops right here. It's converted into a chemical signal, which moves to the skeletal muscle, which then gets converted into another electrical signal inside the skeletal muscle right here. So this synapse is what we call a chemical signal. So the signal changes from electrical within the neuron to chemical within the synapse, and then back again to an electrical signal in the muscle. And guess what that electrical signal in the muscle does? It causes what? The muscle to contract, right? Okay. All right. So your book calls that a synaptic signaling, right? But these are all ways of thinking of synapses. Here is another way that cells can communicate with each other. This is a more long-range signaling mechanism. And you could think of it as endocrine signaling, right? Where you have an endocrine cell that synthesizes and secretes a regulatory molecule into the interstitial space right here. From the interstitial space, it diffuses into the blood, and once it's in the blood, where does it go? All over the body, right? So the blood carries that signaling molecule every place, and then it diffuses from high concentration to low into other extracellular spaces in your body, and so it goes everywhere in your body, but it can cause a response in a target organ or target tissue if this target organ or target tissue has what? It has to have a receptor, and it's got to have a binding site that is complementary to the shape of this signaling molecule. Okay, so what kind of tissue secretes a hormone? It's going to be an endocrine gland. A hormone is something that gets distributed by the circulatory system. That's pretty much a definition of a hormone. Well, there's something else too. You have to know what the definition of an endocrine gland is to know what a hormone is. What's the definition of an endocrine gland? What kind of gland is an endocrine gland? That's anatomy. There are two kinds of glands. There's exocrine and endocrine. So an endocrine is a gland that has what? No ducts. It doesn't need a duct because how does the hormone get distributed? Not via a duct, but by the circulatory system everywhere in the body, right? Okay, an exocrine gland takes this product right here, but it secretes it into a duct which carries it to some part of the body where it has some kind of effect. So a good example of an exocrine gland would be parts of the pancreas that synthesize digestive enzymes. Where do those digestive enzymes work? Should they work in the pancreas? No, because if they did, what would happen to the pancreas? Yeah, it would dissolve. It would digest the pancreas away. Typically, that happens when you have pancreatitis or if you have pancreatic cancer. Those are really tough diseases to have, very difficult to control because the pancreas itself gets dissolved away by those digestive enzymes. But where should those digestive enzymes work? In the gastrointestinal tract, right? So there's a duct that takes digestive enzymes from the pancreas into the digestive tract. And so that part of the pancreas is what we call the exocrine function because it uses a duct with those digestive enzymes. Okay. But an endocrine signal just uses the circulatory system. Okay. Another way to think of regulatory molecules is by what their basic nature is. If they're hydrophobic or hydrophilic, will determine where the receptors for those particular signaling molecules are. So for instance, if something is hydrophobic, what does that mean in terms of moving across the plasma membrane if it's hydrophobic? Can it move across the plasma membrane? Okay. Well, here is that plasma membrane. Here is the barrier. Right? What is the nature of this phospholipid bilayer barrier right here? Is it hydrophilic or hydrophobic? Oops. I clicked it. I didn't mean to click it. It's what? Hydrophobic. Right? So what can dissolve through a hydrophobic region? Only other hydrophobic molecules. Right? So hydrophobic signaling molecules can diffuse across the membrane. Right? So nonpolar or what? Lipid-soluble kinds of signaling molecules can actually enter the cell. This is not a barrier for them. So do you know of a hormone that is hydrophobic? It's like steroids are, right? Steroids can diffuse right through the plasma membrane right here. So there are cytoplasmic receptors, and the shape of the binding site on this receptor has to be complementary in shape to the signaling molecule, right? And when that signaling molecule binds to this receptor, it gets translocated to the nucleus and acts as a transcription factor. Remember, a transcription factor can initiate transcription, which makes RNA. Right, so going from DNA to RNA, what do we call that process? That is transcription, and then messenger RNA can be used by ribosomes to make what? Proteins. What do we call that step? That's translation, right? And those proteins will change the activity of the cell as a result of this signaling molecule. So, right, hydrophobic regulatory molecules have cytoplasmic receptors, right? So it's easy to see how a molecule on the outside of the cell can change the function inside the cell because that molecule has direct access to the inside of the cell. That's not anything too special. So, here are some examples right here. Steroids are hydrophobic, thyroid hormones are hydrophobic, and nitric oxide is actually a neurotransmitter that can enter cells and bind to receptors inside the cell. Yeah.
So the polar
No, it doesn't prevent it through. It can still dissolve right through. Okay. I don't know. Maybe because this outer layer right here is moving around so much. Maybe sometimes it's like this, sometimes it's like that. When it's like that, maybe somebody can sneak through. Okay. That's maybe just one way to think about why that happens that way. Okay, so hydrophobic regulatory molecules like these have cytoplasmic receptors, right? But there are many more kinds of signaling molecules that are hydrophilic, right, that are polar. So can a polar compound move across the membrane all by itself? No, because this phospholipid bilayer excludes them. It's a permeability barrier. So the receptor has to be outside the cell or on the outside surface of the plasma membrane. So here we have some receptor molecules, and you can see here's the binding site. It's nice and complementary to the signaling molecule. All right, and when it binds to the receptor then will initiate or somehow stimulate the production of other kinds of molecules inside the cell. All right, and those other molecules that get formed inside the cell are called second messengers. The molecule that has to stay outside the cell is what we call the first messenger. The first messenger caused the formation of the second messengers. And this process of taking a signaling molecule and making a second messenger out of it is what we call signal transduction. All right, so for many, many years, for decades, people didn't know how hydrophilic molecules that are stuck on the outside of the cell, how they could cause response inside the cell. And today we have some pretty good ideas on how that happened, and we're going to look at those things in this class. We're going to look at signal transduction pathways in this class. So what kind of signaling molecule needs a signal transduction pathway? It's got to be a hydrophilic molecule, right? Where are the binding sites? Where are the receptors for hydrophilic molecules? Outside the cell, right? Or in the cell membrane? Where do you always find first messengers? Inside the cell or outside the cell?
Outside
the cell. Where do you always find second messengers? Inside the cell. And these molecules can't go back and forth. They're either stuck inside the cell or outside the cell. And then what couples a first messenger to a second messenger? It's going to be what? A signal transduction pathway of some kind. Okay. All right. So the first messenger has to bind to the receptor, and then that mediates some kind of action or the production of second messengers inside the cell. What else did I want to say about this? Examples. I thought I gave you some examples. Ah, here's some examples of second messengers. All right, some second messengers could be calcium. Where are you going to find calcium if it's a second messenger? Inside the cell, right? All right, but what can you tell me? Normally, what is the concentration of calcium inside the cell? Is it high or low? It's low, right? But only when the cell is stimulated, when it gets its first messenger, does the concentration of calcium increase, right? And when it increases, that's a signal for the cell to do something. If it's always high inside the cell, then it couldn't be used as a signaling molecule or a second messenger. But normally it's low. That's one of the reasons why it's good to know what the resting concentration is inside the cell. It's low. Cyclic AMP can be used as a second messenger. Cyclic AMP comes from ATP. How many phosphates does ATP have? ATP? ATP has 3, right? And it can be converted into cyclic AMP because AMP only has 1. So we chop off 2 ATPs and form a nice cyclic compound out of it. That becomes cyclic AMP, and that's an important signaling molecule. Where? Inside or outside the cell? Inside, because it's a second messenger, all right? G proteins, which we're going to talk about, and then a couple others that we're going to talk about later in the class. DAG is one of them, and IPI3 is another one, right? So you don't have to really know anything about these yet, but when I mention them again, probably would help to at least have heard about them the first time, right? But you've heard of calcium, right? You've heard of ATP and how it can be converted into cyclic AMP. These are second messengers, so these are things you find where? Inside the cell, that can change metabolism of that cell or functioning of that cell. All right, so a very important transduction signaling pathway has to do with G proteins. And pretty much all forms of life have G protein couple receptors associated with them. These kinds of receptors in an evolutionary sense are extremely old and ancient, and they're incorporated into our physiology as well. We say that they're highly conserved through evolution, right? So these are very, very old kinds of receptors. They're part of a second messenger pathway in many cells. They contain three subunits whose components can dissociate or break apart when the surface receptor is activated. All right, so what kind of signaling molecules can trigger a G protein if it's a cell surface receptor? What's the nature? It's going to be hydrophilic or polar, right? If it's on the surface of the cell, it means that that molecule can't move across, which means what? Hydrophilic or polar, can't move across. I know it's, you got to really keep that straight in your mind sometimes. All right, so, and then when it binds to that receptor, these subunits can break apart and they can move around in the membrane. Why is it that molecules can move around within the membrane? What's a good model to think of the plasma membrane? What is it? The fluid mosaic model. So the membrane is very fluid. Molecules can dissolve around, can move around within the membrane, right? And they can bump into an ion channel, causing that ion channel to open up or maybe to close. It can bump into an enzyme, maybe activate or inactivate an enzyme. You don't know what an enzyme is, but in the next chapter, you'll learn what an enzyme is. It just allows for a chemical reaction to take place. And when that happens, if an ion channel opens or closes or an enzyme is activated or deactivated, that changes the activity inside the cell. It changes the physiology inside the cell. So the G protein coupled receptors change physiology inside the cell. So here is, I think, your last exam figure. And it shows a G protein coupled receptor with the G proteins on it. All right, so here you see the plasma membrane. Here is the regulatory or signaling molecule, which cannot enter the cell. Why can't it enter the cell? Because it is hydrophilic, right? It's hydrophilic. It's a polar compound. But here is a receptor. It can bind to the receptor, and then it activates. This thing right here is what we call a G protein. And how many units does a G protein have? I see three subunits right here. And we call it a G protein because it binds an energy molecule. What's the energy molecule that it can bind? GTP, guanosine triphosphate, similar to ATP, but it's much more ancient energy source. It's a guanosine triphosphate. So that's how we call this a G protein. All right, so let's start, for instance, right here. Here is an unstimulated receptor. Right, I don't see a signaling molecule bound to it at all. And it has a G protein associated with it, and it has bound to it a guanosine diphosphate, which is a relatively low energy molecule. All right, there's not a lot of energy in GTP. All right, when a signaling molecule binds to the receptor, the guanosine diphosphate gets thrown off of the alpha subunit, and that allows GTP to bind on this alpha subunit. And when GTP binds, what is GTP bringing into the G protein? It is bringing energy into that complex. Okay? And when it binds, that causes, and it can only bind when what? The regulatory molecule binds to the receptor. So GTP binds. That causes dissociation of these subunits. The alpha breaks off by itself. The beta and gamma, this little symbol right here is gamma. The beta unit and gamma unit stick together all the time. So that forms a single unit, and the alpha forms a single unit. And these things can move around on the inside surface of the membrane because the membrane is very fluid in nature. Things are moving around all the time by diffusion. So the beta and gamma subunit, when they're wandering around inside the unit, can bump into another protein right here. And this protein could be, for instance, a channel. And it can open or close the channel. It could be an enzyme that's activated or deactivated. Right? So this signaling molecule causes an effect inside the cell because it changes the activity of this protein. The alpha subunit does the same thing. It wanders around. It can bump into a membrane protein, okay, changing the activity of this membrane protein. And after it does so, it dissociates and it wanders back to the receptor molecule, right? And the alpha, beta, gamma subunits form back together again, and then the GTP is hydrolyzed when that happens, and this receptor protein gets reset to the initial condition, ready to listen for another signaling molecule. All right, so this is just a general overview of a G protein coupled receptor. We're going to look at a number of specific examples in the following chapters of the book, but it's from this slide you should know. What should you know from this slide? Where is the receptor for a G protein coupled receptor? Or where's the binding site? Is it inside the cell or outside? It's outside the cell, so it's going to listen for hydrophilic molecules, right? So not for steroids, for instance, that won't work. But other kinds of neurotransmitters that are water soluble, for instance. All right, and it's a G protein coupled because these proteins down here have to bind GTP as an energy source. How many subunits make up the G protein? There are three, right? And they dissociate when stimulated by the regulatory molecule. They dissociate and can wander around inside the plasma membrane, bumping into other proteins, changing the activity of other proteins. And then they go back to the receptor, and when they do, that hydrolyzes GTP, right? And that just activates this whole system right here. So when effectors are changed, that changes the responses inside of a cell. I think that's really important. What's the job of an effector? What does an effector do? It produces what? Remember the response loop? Okay, that's all. Never forget your response loop, because you'll should have a picture of that in your mind all the time in this class. How does a response loop always start? With a stimulus, and it ends in a response. And what produces a response is going to be an effector, right? So, and later on in the class, we're going to have to fill in what some of these responses are, but that would be too much for this test. Okay, so if you see something like this, you're going to call that what? A G protein coupled receptor for typical kinds of hydrophilic molecules. Oh, what is this process called of having this molecule right here cause effects by this effector inside the cell, going from a signal outside the cell to something changing inside the cell? What do we call that? That's what we call signal transduction. So the signaling molecule doesn't have to enter the cell. Okay? It can change activity of the cell. Well, for instance, I could give you maybe one example. This enzyme right here, I said that this effector could be an enzyme. So when the beta and gamma subunit bump into this enzyme might cause the conversion of ATP to cyclic AMP. What did we call cyclic AMP? A second messenger inside the cell that is going to change physiology inside the cell. So this would be an example of an enzyme converting ATP to cyclic AMP, causing the development of the second messenger inside the cell. So if that was the case, this would be called that first messenger, right? And then cyclic AMP produced by this effector right here would be the second messenger. So this would be a nice signal transduction pathway. Okay. So what did I erase on your study guide? Did I erase everything here? Like alpha, beta, gamma, I think I erased all that. Okay, everything on there? Yeah. So that will help you if you can have that picture in your mind. Yeah.
So from the G protein to the effector, that's the signal transduction?
The first signal is this regulatory molecule. So the pathway would include the receptor as well. Right, so it's going to include the receptor G protein complex right here and the effector as well. All those things is the signal transduction pathway.
Then the effector produces something else past the secondary
messenger? Yeah, it produces the second messenger. For instance, if there's ATP here, ATP gets converted into cyclic AMP. So cyclic AMP is going to be the second messenger. Right. All right, so this is a really old kind of receptor that most organisms have. All right, we're going to run into other kinds of receptors. Yeah. Oh, yeah, speak up so everybody can hear. Yeah. Let's see, what do we got? We got a couple minutes left. All right, so I can give you some ways to think about it. And then I'll talk fast. All right, mitosis and meiosis. Here we have a parent cell. How many chromosomes does a parent cell have? 46. But you should remember it's what? Two sets of 23, which is equal to 46, right? And you get one from your mom, one from your dad. And mitosis is going to produce two identical cells, right? With the same complement of chromosomes, 46 chromosomes. So this would be mitosis. And what is mitosis good for? Because at one time you were just this single cell, now you're trillions of cells. For growth is an important reason, or to replace old and damaged cells, because you lose millions of red blood cells every second. Okay, so that's mitosis. What are the phases of mitosis? You got prophase, metaphase, anaphase, telophase. You should sort of know what that looks like, right? Interphase. Interphase is part of the cell cycle, but we don't call it part of cell division. So mitosis is a part of cell division. Interphase is a growth phase, right? Because in order for this cell to have, the parent cell to have 46 and both daughter cells to have 46, what do you have to do with the chromosomes here first? You've got to replicate them, right? So that when you split them in half, both daughter cells have the same number. So during interphase, replication takes place, and replication of organelles and things like that. So that's a growth phase, but not really mitosis.
If you ask part of that, if you ask that question now, would you consider interphase part of mitosis?
I would say interphase, I hope I word a question saying that interphase really is part of the cell cycle, but not mitosis. Okay? So IPMAT mitosis. What else do you want to know about mitosis? Did you want to know some other? Okay, meiosis. All right, so during interphase, here is a chromosome. And we can't split that chromosome up into two daughter cells. We have to do what to? We've got to replicate it. Right? So here is, let's just say that's the number one chromosome. Now we've got two copies of it together. And so here's one here, and here's one here. And then you get a similar one, say, from your dad. These right here are what we call homologous chromosomes. And don't forget, there's the number ones are homologous, the number twos are homologous, the number threes all the way down to number 23. All right, and what do we call these things? Okay, these are sister chromatids. All right, and meiosis separates pretty much like we see for mitosis, but you don't have just one round of separation. You have two rounds, right? You got two rounds. So what happens first, okay, for meiosis, homologous chromosomes separate. So for meiosis, what do you have? You've got prophase 1, metaphase 1, anaphase 1, telophase 1, and then you've got prophase 2, right? Metaphase 2, anaphase 2, telophase 2. So anaphase is when something separates, right? The nuclear material separates. For anaphase 1, what happens anaphase 1? What separates? It's the, yeah, the homologous chromosomes separate. And then for anaphase 2, what separates? The sister chromatids. All right, now here's something else to remember. Since you have two sets of chromosomes inside this parent cell for, at the beginning of mitosis, right, we call this, we can label it 2N. And what does 2N mean? Two sets of chromosomes diploid. And the daughter cells for mitosis are what? The same as the parent cell. The daughter cells are the same as each other. What's the ploidy of the daughter cells? These are 2N as well, right? They have two, both sets of chromosomes. But for meiosis, right, it's a nuclear reduction kind of reaction. Since you have two steps of separation, meiosis right, starts with a 2N cell, which we call a germ cell, right? And it doesn't produce two daughter cells, it produces four daughter cells. And what's the ploidy of these daughter cells right here? They're haploid, which we call 1N. And these daughter cells typically are what we call gametes. And there are two kinds of gametes. What are the two kinds of gametes? Sperm or eggs. These are gametes. So that's what happens during meiosis with two rounds instead of just one. Okay, so this is really general, but I don't know, did you have like a specific question? Or did that help you, your understanding of it? Okay. Okay. Now, how do you get back if these gametes, here's a gamete with 1N, and your body is made out of diploid cells, how does this human life cycle get back to 2N again? Yeah. What's that process called? Let's just say here's an egg, which is 1N. So these gametes come together to form a zygote. And what's the ploidy of that zygote? It contains this set of chromosomes plus the maternal set, so you're back to 2N. All right, and then going from the zygote to you right here, what is that process called? That's mitosis, right? Mitosis is what? Growth. Mitosis is growth. All right, so that's kind of an overview to think of. Yeah. In mitosis, homologous chromosomes don't separate. It's only the sister chromatids. Yeah. All right, so I guess that's it for today. And I'll get the lectures online later today, really late today. If you don't see them today, you can send me an email, okay? Yeah. If you know your CRN number, we can check real quick. Okay, look again. But you know, if you don't see your study guide and you send me an email, I really would like for you to send me an email, but I got to know your CRN number because I've got 14 CRNs. I can't check them all, okay?